August 27th, 2015. This is the Hermetic Hour. I'm your host, Poke Runyon, and tonight we present a discussion on the theory that the biblical Jesus of Nazareth, grandson of King Herod the Great, was in fact not only the King of the Jews, but through marriage to Mary Magdalene, a Phoenician princess and priestess of the goddess, could claim to be King of all Israel, the new Melchizedek. Now, Frater Fabian, that's myself, will again be joined by biblical scholar Frater Solomon, that's Mike, and in explaining this remarkable and exciting story. Now, we will cite the Nicene document of Hippolytus, from which were the romances derived, the Lost Gospel by Jacobovici and Wilson, Robert Gray's King Jesus, and Joseph Raymond's Jesus the Herodian Messiah. Now, this is the beginning of the Holy Grail mystery, so join us for an hour of amazing revelations. And this really is actually very amazing. And this particular story in modern times really starts off in 1946 with Robert Graves' publication of his novel. And it was a novel, and it was published as a novel, King Jesus. And this is what starts this off. But we have had since then several other books, and we have discovered earlier books bear in on this very fascinating mystery. And recently, of course, we've had the Da Vinci Code, and we have Holy Blood, Holy Grail, the Da Vinci Code, and a number of books revolving around that have also contributed to this. And as I said, it also is the background of the Holy Grail myth. Now, some people may be wondering, they may think that the OTA, the Order of the Temple of Astarte, is pagan or neo-pagan, which of course it is. It's also Hermetic. Frater Solomon, are you there?
I am here.
Oh, excellent. Let me finish the intro here, and then we'll get into this. The Order of the Temple of Astarte is certainly neo-pagan, but it's also Hermetic. And as we said on a show just recently, the Order of the Temple of Astarte is in many ways a bridge back in the 1970s when we were having this big neo-pagan and occult revival. It formed a bridge between traditional occultism of the Golden Dawn variety and the witchcraft movement of the Gardnerian and the Robert Graves based witchcraft movement. And we formed a bridge between the two. And so some people may be wondering at this point, well, what is the OTA doing pushing Christianity? Well, we're not pushing Christianity about the fundamental variety at all. We are making another bridge. We're creating another bridge here to a pagan form of Christianity, which was founded by, well, probably founded by Mary Magdalene and Philip originally, but which was really put in place by Saint Valentine, the man who gave us Valentine's Day and who almost became Pope before the Peter and the Paul people, sort of squashed him and slandered him out of existence. But so that's really what's going on here. When we said in the title of this show is Jesus of Nazareth, Pagan Priest King, and that is exactly what we think he was intended to be, and that sort of Christianity is the sort of Christianity that Saint Valentine, and he did manage to get himself sainted, that Valentine and his disciple Marcus, which we follow, and that's the sort of Christianity that we would like to support. So we're forming another bridge here, another bridge between paganism and the Bible and Christianity. And so bear with us. And with that in mind, we're not Christianizing paganism. We're paganizing Christianity. And so this whole business kind of starts off, as I said, with Robert Graves, the same Robert Graves who gave us the White Goddess, and who was responsible for starting a whole school of witchcraft, which ended up becoming the 1734 tradition in this country, the Tubal Cain tradition over in England, and that of course relates that Robert Graves was doing a bridge in that respect himself, you know, with Tubal Cain being the old blacksmith god, both of the Canaanites and the Hebrews and the 1734 Graves tradition witchcraft cult. So there's a lot of cross reference here. Also, too, I might add that the Grail tradition in southern France and in southern England, the Grail tradition has a lot of connection with the witchcraft movement and the pagan movement, and so that's certainly goes right into what we're talking about. Now, this all begins from a modern standpoint with Robert Graves' King Jesus, and what he did in King Jesus that is really remarkable is, number one, he researched it thoroughly, but from a pagan slant. But he researched it very thoroughly, and he discovered that the best candidate for Jesus, the best candidate for his genealogy, his parents, and his genealogical heritage, was the Herod family, and the Herod, you know, King Herod the Great. The same king who supposedly killed all the firstborn in Bethlehem just to try to get rid of Jesus, but then old Herod the Great was famous for wiping out his children, and it appears he even wiped out Jesus' father, Antipater II. And so Graves theorized that Jesus was actually the son the grandson of Herod the Great, and the son of Herod's son, Antipater II. And Antipater, according to Graves, married a woman named Mary, who was the daughter, according to Graves, of a Levite high priest, which gave Jesus, a lineage back through to the Davidians. Although the Herodians claimed a lineage back to the Davidians too. Now, what Graves' book eventually inspired a Roman Catholic seminarian, a fellow by the name of Joseph Raymond, who came out in 2010 with a book called The Herodian Messiah, which he doesn't come right out and admit that he was inspired by Graves' King Jesus, but at least he gives Graves a big footnote, and it's pretty obvious that he was. So what Joseph Raymond did was he did a lot more research than on the biblical end of things, having access to a lot of Roman Catholic material, having been a Roman Catholic seminarian at one time. He went from there to being a lawyer in the Justice Department, if he could figure that one out. But anyway, Raymond comes to some different conclusions about exactly what the Herodian genealogy of Jesus was. Some of which we probably would disagree with. He has Jesus being the son of, or being born of Mary, who Antipater's first wife, and Antipater's first wife was credited, and he was credited because she was credited by Josephus as his first wife. She was the daughter of the Hasmonean king that Herod the Great dethroned and then had executed. He paid Mark Antony a huge bag of gold to chop, to pour, and Antigonus's head off. Herod was great for decapitations, which later on his son Antipas, of course, decapitated John the Baptist. Mike, you want to talk about the two different Marys on the menu here that Raymond is talking about, and he's suggesting the Antipater's first wife, and we're kind of thinking that it might have been his second wife, or possibly the Graves idea. What are your thoughts on that?
There's a couple problems with his first wife, which is why I discount her. But there's also a reason why he came to that conclusion. It's not widely known that Antipater had a second wife, but he did. And people have been trying to dig up her name. But I think I've come up with an obvious argument, which is his wife's always called Mary Amney because whenever his wife's referred to, both of his wives were named Mariamne, which was a common name, especially for people of women of Levitical descent, particularly of Aaron. Just to touch point on the important clans you could be a member of, there were four important clans in Palestine at that time. Foremost was the Zadokite clan. They ran the priesthood. Next to that, it would have been the Hasmoneans. Both Zadokites and Hasmoneans were Levitical. And the next clan in importance would be, of course, your Davidite clan. They descended from the kings, King David, Solomon, the rest. And then the fourth most important clan in Palestine, and Herod married into this as well. In fact, his two sons were part Samaritan. He married a woman named Malthace, and she was the mother of Archelaus and Aristobulus, who were in his will, but he ends up having them executed as well. He killed a lot of his kids. And they were the noble Samaritans were also, they were Levites, but they were of the house of Aaron, but they ran Samaria. They were not really respected by the Judeans or the Galileans. So that's the fourth family.
I think at this point, though, you have to a stopping point on this one, will you?
That's all I wanted to touch on that. That's just to put everything in context. What I want to put in context, though,
because for our listeners, and I know that many of our listeners are not anywhere near as familiar with the Bible as you are, and as I have started to become as a result of a lot of this, so therefore let's put a few of these things in perspective.
Let me point out the problems.
Especially from
Mary Amney. I'm just focusing. I just wanted to. Those are kind of important historical back notes. But Mary Amne is just another variation of Mary. Mary's the kind of a Greek version of Mary Amne, which is a more Aramaic version. So Antipater had two wives. The problem with the Mary Amne that Raymond proposes is, first, she's in jail, and second, she's in her 30s, which doesn't match any of the traditions. This isn't going to be her firstborn child if she's already in her 30s, but she's in jail. So that means his second wife has to be the one by whom he has this child. Now, one thing I noticed from Raymond's book that's really important is Joseph. Antipater had a cousin named Joseph. And this Joseph, he didn't have any heirs that we know of. We don't have a lot of history on him. I do think he was Joseph the carpenter, but that would have been the first choice. Yeah, he was then on his mom's side. That would have been the first choice for Antipater to send his son by Mary that he probably never got to see, because it was about 4 BC and Jesus was born and Antipater was executed, and it's about 3 BC that Jesus is born. So he had to set up for his cousin Joseph to take care of it. There was no Levitical marriage. There was no Levirate marriage for Antipater to have any. He didn't have any little brothers because Doris, his mother, was too old.
Now let's get so people don't get completely lost in all of this. Let's get a few things, a few little basic things out of the way here. Number one, this whole business that we're talking about with Jesus being the son of Herod, the grandson of Herod the Great, and Mary having her own royal line, this all. Basically comes from a couple of things in the Bible and in Josephus, but mainly in the Bible, where number one, and this is very important. Pilate, Pontius Pilate, put a sign on the top of the cross, and this is not speculation or legend, this is a fact. He put a sign on the top of the cross: Jesus of the Jews, Rex Rex Judaeorum. And they didn't want him to put that sign up there, but he put it up there. And Pilate knew. And it's pretty obvious that Pilate knew that Jesus did have this royal blood. Now, another thing, and this is something Joseph Raymond figured out, and that is that the Sanhedrin, the Jewish council, they could not execute Jesus. And they couldn't execute him because they knew he was a Herodian. And if he was a Herodian, he was a high-ranking Roman citizen. Any member of Herod's family was automatically a Roman citizen. And they absolutely could not execute Jesus. And so they turned him over to Pilate, and they asked Pilate to execute him. And so Pilate, Pilate did so at their at their behest, and probably with a large bribe, the same way that Herod, got Mark Antony to kill Antigonus, give him enough gold and chop off his head. Well, somebody probably came up with a lot of gold, and I think it probably was Antipas. That was one of Herod's sons, who was the Tetrarch of Galilee, probably paid Pilate a handsome sum to crucify Jesus. And that's the way they did things in those days. You want the guy dead? Well, it's going to cost you. And so those two things, the fact that Jesus was declared King of the Jews by the Romans, and then executed, because the Jews wanted him executed. And when I say Jews, I mean Judeans, basically. That's another thing. We're going to make this clear. Now, in those days, even though Ezra had made a terrific effort to Judaize all of Israel, and they actually did. They were almost like what we would call evangelical. And of course, in those days, today it's very difficult to become Jewish. As Elizabeth Taylor and others have found out, it takes a lot of work to become a Jew. But in those days, they were converting ever since Ezra, the Second Temple, they were converting. And then, apparently, when the Hasmoneans came in, and the Maccabees, they also went on a conversion. One of the Maccabees, the predecessor of Queen Salome of the Maccabees, he extended the boundaries of Israel out to past what King Solomon had. But here's the rub on that. The 10 so-called lost tribes of Israel were never worshipers of YHVH. They were all worshipers of El. And El, of course, was the father god of the Elohim, and that's feminine, of course, but still it means the gods. And they were the Israelites, the 10 lost tribes, were essentially pagan. And very similar in religious practice to the Phoenicians. And so what we have here is with Jesus is a king of the Jews who wants to recreate the kingdom of, I think, and this is my theory, he wants to recreate the Solomon's kingdom. He does claim some through the Herodian lineage. He does claim some connection to the house of David. He wants to recreate Israel for all the Israelites. And that means that he wanted to purify the temple and get them back to worshiping El in the temple rather than Jehovah. Now this, but Mary Magdalene, of course, would be, and this is where both you and I both take issue with both Graves and Joseph Raymond, is that neither one of them have a real handle on the Mary Magdalene situation. Robert Graves imagined her as a witchcraft, an old hag of a witch, who represented a very primitive version of Judaism. That just didn't work at all, as far as I'm concerned, in King Jesus. But Joseph Raymond, he has Mary Magdalene being another one of the Hasmonean, one of the progeny of Antigonus, and so he has Jesus marrying back into his own family, and I don't go for that either, and I don't think you do either. We discovered that Mary Magdalene was actually the daughter of one of the governors of Syria, who was a governor of Syria under the Romans, but he traced his lineage back to the satraps of Syria and Phoenicia, which means that he could, that somewhere back in her lineage was Hiram of Tyre. And this is, of course, very significant. So I've talked enough on this. You want to take over? Give us your thoughts on this.
Yeah, it's clarification, and I'm sorry if I'm presenting too many details, but it's clarification of Mary Magdalene's ancestry as opposed to the theories that have been promoted. The big one in Holy Blood, Holy Grail is that she was a Benjamite. There's no advantage to Jesus marrying a Benjamite. The Benjamites were mixed in with the Judeans. Judea pretty much consisted of Judah, Benjamin, and Levi. Three tribes in the south, 10 in the north. And that theory wasn't propagated until about 1450 AD. That's the first instance where somebody says that, and that's because Mary Magdalene's equated with Mary of Bethany, and Bethany was in Benjamite territory. However, just because she might have lived in Bethany, she was called Magdalene because she was from Magdala. Magdala is a city in the territory of Naphtali, which is very significant because Naphtali, even though we associate it with Israel, is one of the 13 tribes. There's actually 13, not 12. Levi is sort of a supernumerary tribe. Naphtali and Asher and northern Dan are all part of what old maps show us was really part of southern Phoenicia. So that means that Mary was of Phoenician ancestry. And,
isn't it interesting that Hiram of Tyre in Masonic legend is said to have been, his father was Phoenician and his mother was of the tribe of Naphtali?
Well, yeah, that's really important. Hiram Abyss. That's really important because it kind of points to the Hiram Abyss legend, perhaps pointing to something more ancient than we realize on the surface. Also, it makes the legend of Joseph and Asenath make much more sense, being that Jesus' adoptive father and probably Mary as well were both part Samaritan. Samaritan had some Samaritan noble ancestry, and that would take too long to get into in this conversation. But Samaritans claim their descent from Joseph, so Jesus has that claim on one side of the family. And then Asenath was an Egyptian, so she descended from Ham. Noah had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. So the Phoenicians were descendants of Zidon, Naphtali, and Asher, so a couple of Israelite tribes, and also the ruling Phoenician tribe was from Zidon, which was the son of Canaan, the son of Ham. So here we have Joseph, a descendant of Shem, marrying Asenath, a descendant of Ham. And that's reflected again in Jesus, a descendant of Shem. He's the king of all Shem. Marries the royal princess of Ham. And so we have Shem, and we don't just have all Israel uniting in this marriage. We have the royal house appointed to rule over Ham, and the royal house appointed to rule over Shem marrying each other. And if these Grail legends are true, that means after Shem and Ham united through Mary Magdalene and Jesus, then they had to go to Europe to marry into Japheth. So all three sons are represented in the royal family that Jesus and Mary Magdalene had that was meant to rule over Shem, Ham, and Japheth, all of Noah's sons. Essentially, it's a spiritual family meant to guide the world, which I think Jesus and Mary Magdalene were setting up.
Yes, and we're really connecting the dots, as it were, and everything seems to fit together. Now, let's take another one of these significant books here that we've been talking about, and that's of course Joseph and Asenath. That's the Lost Gospel, and we did a show on that one and a little bit back, which so you guys that are interested in following this can check the archives and check the podcast archives on the show here and get our one on the Lost Gospel. But basically what the Lost Gospel is just to recap quickly, the early Christians back in the time right after Jesus died, and Jesus said that he was supposed to be succeeded by his half-brother, James. Follow James the Just, he said. But we know, though, however, that the church, right after he died, is split in several directions. Peter took the one that ended up being the one that Peter and Paul, the Christianity that we have today, pretty much, that went one way and became the Roman Catholic Church eventually. And then there was this then Mary Magdalene herself had her own following, and maybe perhaps in company with Philip, perhaps, I don't know that, but the Gospel of Philip sure indicates that that might be the case. But anyway, Mary Magdalene, as you know, most of us I think are aware, was a leader of the early church. But the thing that I want to point out here was that in Valentinian Christianity, which Mary and Philip were the sort of the original founders of, Valentinian Christianity, the sacred marriage is the sacrament, more so than the crucifixion. The sacred marriage is the passion. And the Valentinians were not so concerned with the crucifixion. They were concerned with the sacred marriage. Now, why this is important, and why that when we said Jesus was becoming a pagan priest king, along with Mary Magdalene, the Phoenician princess and the priestess of the goddess, is this. In those days, there never was, by the way, in spite of what the feminists would like to think, there never was an age of matriarchy. There never was a matriarchal society in ancient times. They were matrifocal, and at one time the Jews were definitely matrifocal. The Hebrews were. What I mean matrifocal is that, well, like Robert Graves says, the women owned the land, and you married, you know, so they owned the land in a matrifocal society, and you trust your, and at one point, the lineages are traced through the female. Now, interestingly enough, both Gospels, you know, Matthew and Luke, one traces the lineage through Mary, and the other one traces the lineage through Joseph, so you've got two competing male and female lineage there. But marriage was the power, and this is the thing that the feminists don't understand, and I wish they did. Marriage was the power of the women in ancient times. That was their power. That was the marriage was what gave them power and what gave them influence, and therefore this whole business of being able to divorce a woman just by saying I divorce you, which was the way that goes all the way back to Moses. This depowers the woman. And so you can. This depowers the whole feminine claim to any power or any rights, because actually, when a man does that, he divorces her. And in the old days, he got everything. She didn't. So Jesus, and this is very important to our theory here. Jesus in Matthew, when he is questioned by the Pharisees, he's questioned about marriage, and his mentor Hillel, by the way, was actually very liberal on he thought divorce was okay. But Jesus supported the female point of view on divorce. He said, "What God has joined, let no man put asunder." And the whole concept that we still have, that comes down from Valentine, from Jesus and from St. Valentine, the whole concept we have of holy marriage, you know, when we say the rite of holy marriage, the sacrament of marriage, that comes from that, well, that verse in Matthew, but also the whole Valentinian. That was the central core of the Valentinian version of Christianity, was the sacred marriage, re-empowering the female. And Marcus the Valentinian carried that right along, and he and his priestess turned water into wine up there on the altar, and the Valentinians had priestesses, and of course Mary Magdalene was a leader in the early church. So, what I'm trying to say here is that marriage, even though I'm sure a lot of our pagan friends don't, you know, they probably follow the feminist idea that marriage is really not that important. I think the feminists, radical feminists, believe that marriage is a patriarchal way of enslaving women. But that isn't the case at all. It was a way of empowering. It was a way of empowering them. But also, too, it was the rejoining of the separated elements of the soul. Now, Plato is credited with coming up with the idea of the androgynous soul. That's credited to Plato, and maybe it is, but it also appears in Genesis, and so perhaps Ezra and his committee that wrote the Bible, perhaps they were reading Plato. That's certainly possible because Plato was around at that time, but the idea is that the soul is originally male and female, and this is biblical, of course. The soul is originally male and female, and it splits. God splits the soul and divides it, and then he reunites it. But when he takes takes the rib out of Adam and makes Eve for him, he allows the souls to reunite. So when Adam and Eve come together, they become one soul again. And Jesus was very, very much in favor of this, and this was his, and this is the doctrine of the sacred marriage. Now, of course, you know, that doesn't mean that we all have to go out and you know, going to all of these lonely hearts clubs and everything else trying to find our soulmate. That isn't what it means. What it means is if you marry a woman, and of course in the old days those marriages were mostly arranged, unfortunately, but if you marry a woman, you are making her the other half of your soul. And this is very hermetic because, as far as we're concerned in hermetic philosophy, and this is kind of hermetic philosophy, all souls at root core, all souls are identical. They're all part of God. So when you get married, you are, whether she is your secret soulmate or not, you're making her your soulmate. That's what's happening according to Valentinian philosophy and according to what Jesus is promoting. So that is actually, believe it or not, that is a concession to paganism, that preceded this monotheistic tyranny of Jehovah. And this is one of the reasons why I titled this Jesus Christ, the Pagan Priest King, because that's basically what's going on here, and the sanctification of marriage. Mike, you want to make some comments on that?
Well, I think that everything you said self-contained. I'm trying to think, what areas would you like me to add to on that?
Well, I just thought maybe you might have some sidelights or comments on that idea, on the Valentine. You've read the Gospel According to Philip.
Yeah, that's a pretty early source, and it's how we know that Mary Magdalene was extremely important in the community. We also know from the Gospel of Mary Magdalene that she was important to the community. The only reason she was disenfranchised was really because Paul was off doing his own thing in Asia Minor, that's modern-day Turkey and Italy. And he was just out of touch with what they were trying to do in Palestine. We know that Jesus made some really strong stands towards women that were very revolutionary for his day. One thing that Jesus said to stop doing was divorce, because divorce back then, it totally favored the man. It didn't favor the woman at all. Basically, she got disinherited or put away. Herod did that to a lot of to a couple of his wives, to two of his wives. He actually did that to Antipater's mother. When the two of them started having a falling out towards the end of both of their lives, they both died around the same time. So it's also kind of a poke in the eye to Ezra, who forced all his fellows around 400 BC. He says, "All right, you guys, you married Canaanite women, now divorce them and send your kids that you had by them back to their in-laws." So it's really unconscionable. So Jesus is saying, you know, whatever is set up, this is not a good thing. And we're going to stop that, and we're going to start giving women power again. And by marrying the Phoenician, he's also he's marrying the Canaanite, because the Phoenicians were a tribe of Canaanites, or a group of tribes of Canaanites. And he's saying these people need to be included in the plan. He even has... one of his apostles is called Simon the Canaanite. So this is a group that Jesus is trying to include, and he's doing it through marriage. And by doing this union, he's creating that royal connection between the royal line of Ham and the royal line of Shem. Beyond that, I don't think I could add much more. You really capture everything really well.
Well, thanks for that. Anyway, the time we have left, I want to discuss the possibility of the Joseph and Asenath allegory, and the business of Germanicus possibly being. Yeah, that is important. You see, one of the things, and go back to the Lost Gospel. What the Lost Gospel does is it uses the biblical, it's not in Genesis. It is in Genesis, isn't it? Yeah, Joseph and Asenath is it.
Yeah,
it's in Genesis, and. You know, as you all remember from Sunday school, those of you who went to Sunday school, and if you didn't, why didn't you? But and you all remember that Joseph was sold into slavery in Egypt by his nasty brothers. And he had his coat of many colors, his dream coat and all that. So he's sold into slavery by his nasty brothers, but he's so inspired and so clever that he manages to worm his way out of slavery, and he eventually becomes, because he's such a good prophet and soothsayer and all, he eventually becomes the advisor to Pharaoh. And in the process of all of this, he marries a high priest's daughter, Asenath, and marries the high priest's daughter, and has a couple of children, and he's working his way up to become actually almost the administrator for the whole kingdom. He's virtually the Pharaoh's, prime minister, what they would call over in Arabia, Grand Wazir. Anyway, so what happens though is that his brothers, that the ones that sold him into slavery, they have a famine up there in Canaan, and they come back down to in Egypt, and they find here they find their brother that they sold into slavery. Oh my God! Yeah, this guy has become virtually the ruler of Egypt, and sure enough, they end up conniving against him. He forgives them and all of that. Then they end up conniving against him, and Pharaoh's son, according to this story, at least the version of the story that the Christians wrote in the last gospel, Pharaoh's son, I don't think this is in Genesis, Pharaoh's son lusts after Aseneth. He thinks that he should have married Aseneth. And so he conspires with the brothers, and what ends up happening is that Pharaoh's son, before he can capture Aseneth and take her away, he gets killed. So we're left with this story that we are virtually certain, and Jacobovici and Wilson have made a very good case for this. We're virtually certain this is a Christian allegory, that this does represent Jesus and Mary Magdalene. Now, we did another show on that, so I'm not going to go back into that, the honeycomb and all of the sacred marriage and the whole business, but it's pretty obviously a Christian, and it's thing we know it was written by Christians anyway. But Jacobovici and Wilson are suggesting is that that Pharaoh's son was really the Roman general Germanicus, who had been assigned the governorship of Syria, but before he could actually take his position as governor, he was poisoned by one of his Roman associates. And what they're suggesting is that he wanted to marry Mary Magdalene. Well, if what we found out that Mary Magdalene was apparently Jacobovich and Wilson didn't get this, but Mary Magdalene was the daughter of the former governor of the preceding governor of Syria, who was also a Roman appointee, and yet he was related all the way back to the royalty of the Phoenicians, so this would be very, very, very advantageous for Germanicus coming in as the governor of Syria to be able to marry Mary Magdalene, and that would really solidify his position and his power. So it's very possible that he was working to have that arranged. And that's what they suggest, but they didn't know. They go further than that. They actually have him going down in the field and trying to, you know, getting involved and trying to kidnap her and everything. None of that probably happened because Germanicus, instead of him going to Syria and taking his seat as he on the way, he went on a sightseeing tour in Egypt and digressed and went and looked at the pyramids and whatever. By the time he got to Syria, they were already poisoning him, and so he probably never had a chance to meet Mary Magdalene. So if they are right, if Jacobovich, Vici, and Wilson are correct, then it must have been prearranged that whole thing would have been. What do you think about this, Mike?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that that's exactly what Germanicus wanted to do, and I think at first Mary Magdalene's father, his name was Theophilus Cyrus, he would have been favorable, thinking, yeah, this is a great idea. I'll connect to the Caesar family, and I'll unite with them, and we'll become a lot more powerful. However, Tiberius had a problem with his son Germanicus. Germanicus was really arrogant. He was really unruly, not unlike his father. But, of course, you know, like father, like son, Tiberius didn't want somebody with a big head like him going to fight against him. It seems these powerful royal families, they have a lot of infighting. Some of that might be caused by inbreeding, but a lot of it's just power hunger. So what Tiberius did to stall this was he appointed someone else to be in charge of the area when Germanicus was going there, thinking it was his to take over. He appointed his friend Gnaeus Piso. And Gnaeus Piso's job under Tiberius was to prevent Germanicus from getting power over that region by giving Gnaeus Piso the official governorship of that area. So Gnaeus Piso would have gone in and told Theophilus, hey, Theophilus, you don't want to do this because it might have been a good idea at first, but Tiberius Caesar's decided he does not want this to go through. So you need to keep this place under control, and you need to make sure this doesn't happen. That was his job. Gnaeus Piso was the one who arranged for Germanicus to be cut off. So when Germanicus goes into Syria thinking he's going to take over, Gnaeus Piso arranges to cut him off.
Yep, that's probably when that probably is the way it went down, and that means that then actually Jakubowicz and Novici and Wilson are probably correct in their assumption. And now the only thing we need to do to wrap this whole thing up is to figure out how Jesus, with all of this stuff going for him and everything, all of this going for him, how did he end up getting nailed up on the cross? And I think that the answer to that is that the money to get Pilate to do it came from Jesus' own relation, Herod Antipas, the Tetrarch of Galilee, because Jesus was a direct threat to Herod Antipas, and who was his brother in a scene, wasn't he?
He was his half brother. Herod Antipas comes through. Herod Antipas was the son of Herod's wife. I believe it was Malthus, the Samaritan. And so Jesus, being the son, being the grandson of Herod, and Jesus would have been the last descendant of the Davidian wife, the only Davidian wife that Herod had, which was Doris. She was the daughter, and as far as we know, only child of Jesus Bar Panthera. She was the last heir, and that was an actual historical figure. He was the heir of the Davidian line, and he was in charge of the Sanhedrin in his day. He's the most credible. Jesus is the most credible descendant of Herod to rule the house of David, to be the house of David to rule Israel.
Yeah, so
Herod
Antipas
has to get rid of him because he doesn't have the credentials.
Herod Antipas would have, as I said, he would have. Well, Graves does some speculation along this line, but I think it's pretty obvious that using the Mark Antony, Herod the Great's paying Mark Antony to execute Antigonus. That's the template for this, and that is the template for the crucifixion of Jesus. So Antipas knew that pay Pilate enough and Pilate will do the job. And of course, the Sanhedrin wanted it done too. They could not kill Jesus because he was a Roman citizen, and so between the Sanhedrin and Caiaphas between the Caiaphas and Antipas together, I think they put together quite a kitty for Pilate. And he said, "All right, I'll kill your king for you, but I'm going to embarrass the hell out of you by putting a sign up on the cross that says that this is your king," which he did.
There's also a reason. Pontius Pilate was a very astute politician. He's scaring the Jews. A lot of Jews liked Jesus. The ones in power didn't, because he was a threat to their power. But a lot of the common people really liked him. He was a uniter, and he was a kind of a populist. So by putting Jesus Christ, King of the Jews, what Pontius Pilate is saying is, hey, you Judeans who want to rebel, I just killed your leader.
And that's very true, because Another thing we didn't mention, you know, and in talking about the actual character of Palestine at that time, it was just as volatile and as they didn't have rockets to fire and all, but they were just as volatile then as and they had one revolt after another. In fact, they were having a revolt just about the time Jesus was crucified. They were having another one, and all of this. All of this was going on constantly. They were constantly in a state of rebellion, and I think, and this is one of the reasons too why I think that Jesus's parables and his teachings are so incredibly liberal. You know that it's Robin Hood all the way. You know, let's take from the rich and give to the poor, which. Of course, one of the reasons for that is that the wealthy in those days, the ones who had all the money were the ones that were the highest in the priesthood and the highest in the Jewish nobility, and they were the ones with the money, and they were the ones with the, you know, with the property, and they were the ones that owned the land, and the Canaanites. And the other Israelites, you know, even though they might profess to be Jewish, you know, on the surface and all, they were still, you know, they still paid obeisance to the Queen of Heaven, and they were still a lot of them were pagans at heart, and they were virtually serfs. So I think that a lot of Jesus's you know, Jesus' altruism is really let's give Israel back to the Israelites. You know what I mean? I think.
Yeah.
Blessed be the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. And we made them meek because they're afraid to raise their heads. You know. So anyway, I think we're about out of time. Next week, at the request of a couple of our members, we've had a forum on the website about suggestions for what to do, what kind of shows to do on the Hermetic Hour, and one of our members suggested, well, why don't you do a series on the spheres of the Tree of Life, and like we did one on the paths, and that was very successful. Everybody loved that. So we're going to start a series on the spheres,
and we'll start at the bottom and we'll go up to the top. And so next week, Malkuth, the kingdom, and you know.
So we'll start a new series on the spheres, and thank you so much, Brother Solomon. And I think this is a show that probably will get a lot of food for thought and a lot I hope we get some good commentary on it. And we'll see you all next week. And until then, good magic.
Good magic.